The reading is on the screen for you there from Matthew chapter 16. From that time on, Jesus began to say plainly to his disciples, I must go to Jerusalem and suffer much from the elders, the chief priests, and the teachers of the law. I will be put to death, but 3 days later I will be raised to life. Peter took him aside and began to rebuke him. God forbid, Lord, that will never happen. Jesus turned around and said to Peter, get away from me, Satan. You are an obstacle in my way because these thoughts of yours don't come from God, but from human nature. And Jesus said to his disciples, if any of you wants to come with me, you must forget yourself, carry your cross and follow me. For if you want to save your own life, you will lose it. But if you lose your life for my sake, you will find it. Will you gain anything if you win the whole world but lose your life? Of course not. There is nothing you can give to regain your life. For the Son of Man is about to come in the glory of his Father with his angels, and then he will reward each one according to his deeds. I assure you that there are some here who will not die until they have seen the Son of Man come as King. This is the word of the Lord. Now, these are quite difficult words, and I'm not going to try and go through every bit of them because there's a lot there and it would take us far too long. Last week, we thought about the cross of Christ being a unique moment when salvation was achieved. But we also thought briefly about carrying the cross as the lifestyle that we are called to and the importance of keeping those two things in balance. After the service, I got into a conversation about what that actually means, to carry the cross. What does it mean to take up your cross and follow Jesus? Familiar enough phrase, but maybe not that easy to understand. In fact, there are so many phrases from the Bible that have found their way into our language. About 60 years ago, when they wrote the New English Bible, they wanted to try and get some of the idioms in the New English Bible and put them into more contemporary English. And somebody went to an established family butcher and said, what do you call it when you, and he was thinking about the prodigal son, he said, what do you call it when you actually butcher a whole animal for a family celebration? What would that be called in your industry? And the butcher said, oh, no, we've got a name for that. We call it killing the fatted calf. So in fact, so many people in our society have sort of pinched and used phrases from the Bible. And you often hear people say, this is my cross to bear. Often they're referring to some noisy neighbour or a physical scar or a personal tragedy. And quite often it's something that is not connected to anything particularly Christian. I mean, I'm a Reading supporter, so that's fairly depressing from week to week. I could say that's my cross to bear, but really, it's not a spiritual matter, is it? So I'm not sure that we use the phrase carefully or even correctly. What did Jesus actually say? He said, if anyone wants to come with me, they must forget themselves, carry their cross, and follow me. Now, people these days wear crosses on chains around their necks, and we often forget that the cross was the preferred Roman method of execution. It was humiliating for a start off. A person was stripped naked before they were hung on the cross. We've been very modest about these things in our depictions and we've always thrown in a loincloth, but that wouldn't have been the way it was. It was utterly humiliating. We get our word excruciating from a word that we also use, crucifix. It's the word for the cross. Excruciating pain is very bad pain. And that's what crucifixion was like. You had to make a choice if you were being crucified. You would have had nails driven through your wrists, but also through your ankle. And you had to decide whether to hang your weight from your wrists or try and prop yourself up on your ankles. If you did the latter, prop yourself up on your ankles, it was very painful as gradually a metal spike tore through your sinews. But equally, if you took your weight on your arms, you would struggle to breathe and you would begin to asphyxiate. And on top of that, gradually you would also dehydrate. It was a long, painful way to die. It was something the Romans deliberately chose to use on people who rebelled against the state as a warning to others. Sometimes you would survive for more than 24 hours before eventually you would pass away. To carry the cross in those days meant that you were on your way to execution. But not so these days. These days you can make a good living out of the cross. Laura once told me in Ghana, if you want to be rich, start a church, because you can make a lot of money out of the cross these days. And in the West, let's face it, to be a pastor seems to be anything but carrying a cross. In America, they produce an annual top 20 rich pastors list. You see a lot of them on the God Channel. It pays. If you've got the personality and the charisma, you can do well. All you need is a magnetic personality and ability to quote the Bible fluently and confidently, and the money will roll in. Joseph Prince, who's a young God Channeler, he's worth $5 million. Joyce Meyer, you've probably seen her, $8 million. T.D. Jakes, $18 million. Billy Graham, who died last year, was worth $25 million. Creflo Dollar, what a name is that, eh? Creflo Dollar's worth $27 million. Benny Hinn, $42 million. Benny Hinn's just renounced all that prosperity teaching. We'll see what he does with his personal fortune, though. David Oyedepo, $150 million. But top of the rich list is Kenneth Copeland, who has an amazing $760 million. It's a good deal carrying the cross these days. It's been superseded. Carrying the cross has been superseded by carrying a very large wallet, it seems to me. In fact, one person commented, when mega church pastors need money, they ask their followers. When their followers need money, they're told to ask Jesus. Anyway, back to the real meaning of the cross. I believe that to carry your cross is to embrace the way of rejection. The whole point about Jesus is that he came proclaiming a different way of doing things, what we sometimes call a counterculture. And he always knew that it would be rejected. Not by everyone, but certainly when you came to the upper echelons of power, the vested interests, they would certainly reject it. So as he set off for Jerusalem, he told his disciples that he would encounter hostility, rejection, and death. And sure enough, that's exactly what happened. So you have to get behind the idea of death and recognize that rejection lay at the root of it. When Jesus calls us to die, he doesn't just tell us to walk out in the road and die after the service today, but he encourages us to embrace this counterculture that is so different from the culture of our society. To follow in Jesus' footsteps will lead to a cross. In this sense, not necessarily that we will be martyred like he was, but that what we stand for will be rejected by the majority of people. That's quite a depressing thought, isn't it? And yet it's completely in line with what Jesus said about a narrow road that leads to life and a broad road that leads to destruction. And when you look around, the broad road is the road that has the most people on. We are called to be voices in the wilderness, lights in the darkness. So when you take up your cross, I think what it means is that you are embracing the radical way of Jesus. You are being countercultural. You are running the risk of conflict. And certainly that's true in a number of countries around the world. You are saying, I'm following Jesus, and for him, that led to a cross, and it might lead to something bad for you as well. You may or you may not suffer, but you will attend to two things as you think about the counterculture. You will attend to your values, and you will attend to your sense of vocation. So briefly, let me talk about those two things, your values, first of all. Now, a value is something that you hold in your heart and your head. And you then expect it to affect your behavior. In business, a company will often spell out what its values are, and then in the light of these, how they expect their employees to behave to their customers and to each other. So, for example, One of your core values may be that your business has integrity, because that sounds good, doesn't it? You know, our business has integrity. What does that mean? Well, then they'll list it out. When work when you are supposed to, don't take overlong breaks. Be scrupulous in your transactions and intentions. Do what you say you will do. Follow it through. Own up to your mistakes. Work to correct them. Use materials for their intended use, not your personal use. Work together as a team. Be inclusive. Identify and disclose any conflict of interest. Be open and transparent. Put everything on the table. So you see, the values lead on to behaviour patterns. Or it may be that the value is respect. Again, it sounds good, doesn't it? You know, we embrace respect. So what does that mean? So you expect your staff to be patient with each other, to be tolerant, to be polite to each other, to be friendly to each other and to customers, to be inclusive, to be considerate, to be courteous. And then it goes on to make you think, well, what should the core values of a church be? I'm sure integrity would be one of them, and probably respect would be another, and you could probably come up with a long list. But I just came up with three things. One of the core values is a focus on Jesus. Seems to me that's very important. If you begin to develop a spirituality that doesn't mention Jesus, then you're going to have a problem. There's something about the way that Jesus spoke that's very clearly pointing to himself and saying, this is the way to follow. Jesus it was who said, I am the bread of life. And Jesus it was who said to his disciples, you're going to leave me and go off with the others. And they said, no, you have the words of eternal life. Jesus it is who said, I am the way, the truth, and the life. And I've always found that interesting. Jesus says, I am the way. Sometimes people want answers, but Jesus says, you may not find the very individual answers you want, but I am the way to follow. Follow my way of life. And I am the truth. You know, we look for truth in books usually, but here we're encouraged to look at Jesus, the person. He is the truth. Jesus needs to be central. And what we do on Sundays, I think, is very important, because we're coming back constantly to the life of Jesus and saying, are we living our lives in the way that Jesus lived his? To adopt the way of the cross doesn't just mean those last few hours of Jesus' life. It's meaning adopting that countercultural way of living that led to the cross for him. And then it's about people as well. There needs to be something about people mattering. Jesus got this lovely story, or Mark tells the story in a lovely way, of two females. There was a young girl who was 12 years old. It was the daughter of a very rich Jewish leader. She was very sick. In fact, she was dying. And the leader comes to Jesus and said, would you come and heal her? And Jesus said, I'll come. But on his way, he gets distracted by another woman. A woman who's much older, but a woman who has been ill for 12 years. The connection of 12 is very, very important. And she has a condition that makes her unclean in society. And so she's taking a risk actually being part of the crowd. But she goes and stretches out and touches Jesus' coat. And in that moment, she's healed. And Jesus knows that something's happened. Some power's gone out from him. So he says, who did that? People say, you know, well, everybody's touching you, Jesus. You know, what are you saying? And he says, no, somebody has drawn on my healing power. And eventually she comes forward and she explains herself. And there's a lovely touch to that chapter in Mark chapter 5, where he says to her, my daughter, your faith has made you well. And then he comes to the other daughter, the rich daughter, and says, arise. Here was a kind of class divide, a daughter who had privilege and a woman who was excluded. And Jesus didn't differentiate between the two. He was prepared to bring healing to both. We need to recognize that all people matter, whether they're the same skin color as us, the same cultural background, whether they're migrants. One of the struggles that I have, and many of you know that I voted to leave the EU for particular reasons that I've kind of worked through in my own mind. But I certainly don't identify with those people who just say, let's get immigrants out of here. You know, they're a block on what's happening in our nation. I find that immigrants are here and prepared to work And it's a horrible thing that is being said. All people matter. And when you come across people whose lives are broken and they're feeling lost, you need to step in and help them. One of the great difficulties we have at the food bank is that there's a kind of rule that we say that the food bank is for people who don't have money and need food. If people have money but misspend it, then they shouldn't be coming to the food bank and then just getting free food. They ought to learn how to budget their money and use it properly. But there's a kind of group in the middle of that that get referred to us by a group called CGL Newham Rise. It's a funny kind of name, but it's basically dealing with people who have addictions, whether it's alcohol or drug addictions. And their lives are pretty messed up, and they get referred to us all the time. And of course, they've got money, but they're misusing the money. So part of me says, well, shouldn't help these people. But the other part says, but actually, this is a journey they're on. They need help to kind of get through this. People matter. And that's a core value. And then another one is this, that righteousness is more important than ritual. We've talked about this before. The Old Testament prophets constantly railed against the religion of Israel, which had become corrupted by the surrounding nations. And what happened in Israel was they were given laws by Moses, which put great emphasis on care within their own community, that they looked out for each other, and that there were poor people. In fact, at one point, Moses says, if you follow the laws that I'm giving you today, there will be no poor people among you. But that's not the way it turned out. And instead, they adopted customs from other surrounding nations that put great emphasis on ritual and sacrifices and festivals, but not on just laws and righteousness. And so Amos famously says, I despise your religious festivals. Your assemblies are a stench to me. Even though you bring me burnt offerings and grain offerings, I won't accept them. Though you bring choice fellowship offerings, I will have no regard for them. Away with the noise of your songs. I won't listen to the music of your harps, but let justice roll on like a river, righteousness like a never-failing stream. Values. So, what is it that matters to you? Are you a shopping addict who finds meaning in wearing nice clothes? Is having things what gives you a buzz in life? When someone annoys you, you just write them off and blank them after that? Get behind your behavior patterns and ask yourself the question, what is it that really matters to me? And does that harmonize with what matters to God? And at times you'll find that you're in tune with other people, and at times you'll find that you're out of step. And quite often I find that I'm in tune with people who are not Christians. Yesterday at football again, had a conversation with one of the fathers who was looking for some other kind of further football and saying, is there somewhere else that my son can go to get help with the football? And I said, well, I wasn't kind of aware of what's going on. I know there are other academies around. And he tried some, and they were just far too competitive. And he said on one occasion it was a match where the coach got sent off and the whole thing became too competitive and aggressive. And he said, what I like about your group is that it's inclusive and there's a morality about it. So credit where credit's due. There are, you know, people who are not signing up to the Christian faith and yet recognize that what we do is good. Peter Tatchell, of past and present fame, once said that the Bible had been superseded by the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. But I would say it's one thing to say that you believe something, it's something else to do it. And your behavior patterns reveal your values. And that's why we have confession in our prayers and why we use the Bible like a mirror to look at ourselves and what needs changing. I like the story of the farmer in Russia years ago. I don't know if it really happened or whether it's just a joke, but in the days where state socialism took over, and somebody was trying to educate the farmer, and he said, so, you know, we're all part of the family now. We all share with each other. So if you had two houses, would you give one away? And he said, oh, yes, I would, he said. And he said, if you had two tractors, he said, would you give one away for the use of wider society? And he said, oh, yes, definitely. And he said, if you had two horses, would you give one away? And he said, no, I wouldn't do that. He said, well, why not? You give your house away and a tractor, why not the horse? And he said, because I've got two horses. And the reality is that, you know, sometimes our values are slightly skewed and we're not prepared to actually live out what we really think. Communism says, what's yours is mine, and it's driven by envy. Christianity says, what's mine is yours, and it's driven by love. So think about your values as a basis for all of this. And the other thing is about your vocation. And we've gone past time today, but it's quite a fancy word, vocation, but it just means calling, literally, your calling. What is your calling in life? I had to lead an ordination service yesterday of a woman, a new minister that I've been supervising over in Ilford. And it's an interesting story. Before service, I was talking to her son and daughter, and the daughter's studying medicine. I said, you're going to be a GP at the end of it. She said, well, I'm getting really interested in surgery now. And the son, who's in year 10, said, yeah, I'm thinking about going into medicine now and all of this. It's quite an interesting family story because she came from a Hindu background, got a good education, went into some scientific field, got herself a PhD, met her husband, and gradually he loved her to Jesus, and she became a Christian. And then in her 40s, she felt called to ministry. This sense that God doesn't just call you in your earlier years. We put such a lot of pressure on young people. They are having to make career decisions about what they're going to do in their late teens and early 20s. And we often describe certain jobs, teaching and nursing being two of them, as being vocational because there's not so much money in them as commercial jobs. But vocation simply means calling. And for us as Christians, the question is, what is God calling us to do? How does he want us to spend our time? And I think our vocation is very simple, to be agents of God's salvation and good news. And the wonderful thing about church is that we can do things together that we could never do on our own. A few of us, a few weeks ago, went to the funeral of George Whitehorn. He'd been a member of the Friday Lunch Club the last 10 years that we've been going. And he was 95 years old, and we went to pick him up one day, and there was no answer. I phoned his daughter. When they got to the flat, he passed away at some point. And she sent us the details about the funeral, and the funeral was held at his church in East Ham. And a bunch of us went along to it. It was a good turnout, actually, from the lunch club of those who went. And a couple of days ago, I got a card through from her, and the card was a really nice card, and inside it said, the Friday Lunch Club meant such a lot to George. He was able to get out once a week and look forward to that. It wasn't just doctors and hospital appointments, but it was a chance to be with people. And enclosed in the envelope, a gift of £150 to the church. I thought that was so sweet, and I thought it was nice that we as a church couldn't do it individually, but as a church, as a group of people, we can provide that kind of ministry to people. It's part of our vocation. I remember ringing George up and say, are you coming today? And he'd say, oh, yes. And always the same, every kind of, and then I'd say, how are you, George? And he'd say, well, 50-50. And I'd say, do you mean 50-50 or 70-30? And same old conversation week after week. And there's so many things I never knew about him, but nonetheless, it was something that he greatly appreciated. So how is God calling you to serve him in the church? Or are you completely locked into your job and your family? Strange sermon to write. I've defined carrying your cross as embracing the selfless and rejected way of Jesus. Yet invariably, I don't encounter hostility. Indeed, neither did Jesus on a daily basis. It was only in that final week that the rejection of the powers that be took him to a cross. We can embrace selflessness, but we cannot create hostility. We can, however, give thought to our values, to those things that really matter, and we can open our ears to what God is calling us to be doing. And I hope you'll give some thought to that this week. Amen.